Hi there. Welcome to the Physics 123 lecture for January 23rd, 2013. Hope you can get comfortable. You want to pull up the slides that are available on the website, and this lecture will be following along on those slides. So if you open up those slides and you look at the first page, you will notice in the upper right-hand corner a number 1, a blue 1 surrounded by a circle. And I will have on all of these pages such numbers, and I'll be referring to the pages by their number. So last time we started to talk a little bit about relativity. It was very conceptual at the time, and I want to just remind you of what we talked about. Einstein made two postulates that underlie relativity. The first is that the speed of light is the same, and we'll use the symbol c to represent the speed of light. It's about 3 times 10 to the 8th meters per second. So it is. He assumed that it's the same in all inertial reference frames. And this basically comes out from experimental observation. And it's an observation that people at the time were incredulous about, because in Newtonian physics we lived in this mechanical world where we understood waves to be things that propagated in media, and you've probably seen that before, but we'll certainly see it again. Waves will be our next topic, and we'll certainly study mechanical waves. And I think when you study mechanical waves, it's pretty easy to understand how strange the idea that that velocity wasn't relative in different reference frames had to be, which is basically what you were getting out of Michelson-Morley. So this is very strange. In special relativity, the word special refers to the fact that that we are considering situations where reference frames are moving at constant speeds with respect to each other. And just to give you a sense, we're going to talk a lot about reference frames and transformations of observables from one reference frame to another. And this really is at the core of science, right? Because in science we make observations, and what you want to do is then take these observations and convey them to others in such a way that they can repeat them. And clearly we need to understand how anything we observe will look to observers that are moving with respect to us. So the whole idea of relativity, this understanding how things look from different reference frames, is really at the core of science. So it's very, very important. At any rate, in special relativity, you're talking about a very particular situation, which is that you are considering the transformation of observables from one reference frame to another where they are moving at constant speed with respect to each other. So no acceleration, no rotation. The other assumption that Einstein made underlying special relativity is that the physics is the same in all reference systems. So whatever, you know, fundamentally is known to happen and observed, the essence of it has to also be true in all the other reference frames. If I drop an egg and it breaks in one reference frame, I know the egg is broken in the other reference frames as well. So let's go to page 2. Now, on page 2, I show the canonical relativity train with Sam on the train and Sally off to the side. And in class last time, we considered the situation where the event we considered was a ray of light that was being sent from the floor of the train, bounced off a mirror in the ceiling, and came back down and was detected at the floor. And think of the event as being the emission and detection of that light. And we examined it from two points of view, from the point of view of Sam, who is on the train. For Sam, the light seems to go straight up, seems to come straight down. It's emitted and detected in the same position of space with respect to him, if he's just sitting there, as both the emission and detection happen at the same point. So the path that Sam sees is to the left of the A in a... If you look, I have an A in a blue circle. Just to the left of that, where the pink arrows go straight up and straight down, a distance H, that's basically what Sam sees. Sally, on the other hand, is sitting off to the side, and the light is emitted, it moves up, it hits the ceiling, it comes back down to the floor, but during the time that the light is moving, it's in transit, the train is also moving, which means Sally has to perceive this event to happen. Basically where the light travels a path like that scene just to the right of the A in a circle. And if the height is the same in both these cases, you can see that the path would have to be longer for Sally. Therefore, if we constrain the speed of light to be the same in both points of view, then the time that Sally measures must be longer than the time that Sam measures. And in fact, we derived that, and we got the expression where I have a C in a circle, where the time of Sally is related to the time of Sam, where Sam, the time that Sam measures is multiplied by this quantity called gamma, which is 1 over the square root of 1 minus the quantity V over C squared. If you look at that quantity, if V is much smaller than C, the term V over C is negligible, and you end up with just 1, and the times are the same. And if V is a large fraction of C, then the quantity in the square root is less than 1, and you end up with a number gamma that can become quite large. And so what we're saying is that if the train is going at some relatively large fraction of the speed of light, the time that Sally measures is considerably longer than the time that Sam measures. And if it goes, the closer it is to the speed of light, the larger is that discrepancy. We call this time dilation. And one of the reasons we call it time dilation is that there is a frame in which the time is measured to be shortest, and that is the proper frame. So in the frame of reference where Sam is, the event that happens at one place in his reference frame. So that's actually a special reference frame. If you think of anyone moving with respect to Sam, if you have the emission and the absorption of the light defined as your event, it happens over some finite period of time. And if someone is moving with respect to Sam, the absorption and the emission cannot happen at the same place in any other reference frame. So Sam's reference frame is very special, and we call that the proper frame. And if we look at our expression, gamma is always going to be greater than or equal to 1. And so the time in any other reference frame moving at V with respect to Sam's reference frame is going to be larger or equal to Sam's. So often, if we look where I have a B in a circle, often this is written as sort of some delta T times a gamma delta T prime, or delta T prime is equal to some gamma times delta T. Very often people will use primes to denote the different reference systems. So very often we'll talk about reference system S and that reference system S prime moving with respect to S. Just note that the prime really just is very case specific. It denotes a different reference system and denotes those variables as measured with respect to that reference system. But there's no general rule that says the unprimed system is the one at rest or the proper frame and the primed system is the other frame or the other way around. So do not, whatever you do, get hung up on this prime and start going into the mode of pattern recognition and say, oh, that's prime, therefore it's the proper frame. That's just absolutely wrong. Prime is nothing but a notation denoting the particular reference frame. So the way to think about these kinds of problems is not to think about whether it's a prime or not. What you want to do is to think, okay, I have two times measured in different reference frames. I'll denote them as unprime and prime, related by gamma. And I will just write down, okay, delta T is equal to gamma delta T prime. Which reference frame is which? How does this really work? Well, what you need to remember is time dilation. time is shortest in the proper frame, that is the special frame, and that then has to be the side where the gamma is, because that's the thing that gets multiplied, become larger, because you have time dilation. So the way that I have written, where you have a B in a circle, the delta T prime is in the proper frame, because it's the thing that gets multiplied by something greater than 1 to give you delta T, which has to be a time which is longer because you have time dilation. That's the kind of thinking you want to do. So don't get hung up on notation. Just make sure that you understand the time is shortest in the proper frame, and then do your thinking accordingly and be consistent with the notation. So if we go to slide 3, in slide 3, I show a schematic where the idea is that Sam and Sally are each measuring the length of the train, and in this case the light is emitted from the back of the train, goes to the front and bounces and comes back to the back, and Sam on the train can measure how much time it takes for the light to go back and forth. And knowing the speed of light, he can then calculate the length of the train. Sally can do the same thing, and what we will find is that the two lengths are also related by a gamma. So where I have a blue A in a circle, I have an equation delta x is equal to gamma delta x prime. Again, I haven't really specified what is delta x prime. It turns out if I do specify that by doing the example, which is something I'll ask you to actually calculate this for one of your homework problems, that you derive that the length that Sam measures is equal to gamma times the length that Sally measures. In other words, the proper frame is the longest length, because delta x Sam divided by gamma, that is going to be the length Sam measures divided by a number greater than 1, will give you whatever Sally sees. And Sally basically represents any other reference frame. So, similar to the time dilation, we have length contraction. And again, you don't get hung up on whether it's a prime or an unprime. You get hung up on the fact that the longest length that you measure, this is along the direction of relative motion, the longest length you measure is in the proper frame. And if anyone else measures that length along that direction, and they're moving with respect to the proper frame, they will measure a number that is shorter. And that's what the equations show us here. Now, I mentioned already, this is only along the direction of relative motion. If we look at what's happening in the transverse dimension lengthwise, we find that the lengths don't change. So things are clearly, our concept of space and time, where we think of space as three immutable dimensions basically marching at a constant rate through time in one direction, it's just wrong. If we look at this, it's very clear that one's perception of time and space are observer dependent, and this is really quite different from what our human bias and experience would lead us to believe. And the reason that that's okay, or the reason that we can drive, I mean, we can do our commutes and not kill each other with this faulty perception of space and time, is the fact that our velocities, we have evolved in a situation where the velocities are small with respect to the speed of light. So our bias, our perception, has evolved to be useful in the world in which we find ourselves. You don't need to do relativistic corrections to go out and kill a deer and eat. So I find it sort of interesting that we are products of the bias that we need to survive. At any rate, so let's go to slide 4. that was sort of a summary of where we've been, and now what I'd like to do is to look at things a bit more formally. So on slide 4, what you see is that I have drawn two basic reference systems that are moving with respect to one another along the x direction. So each of them has an origin. One of them I will call the S system, and the other I will call the S prime system. Okay, so if we go to slide 4, you'll note that I have drawn two reference frames. One I call frame S, and it has an origin of O, and the other I call S prime, as an origin of O prime. S has an x-axis, a y-axis, and z-axis. S prime has an x prime, y prime, and z prime axis. S prime is moving with respect to S. It is moving to the right as I've drawn it. It is moving along the x direction. Note that the orthogonal axes are parallel for the S and the S prime system. Some event E happens somewhere in 3 space, which I have denoted with the orange dashed lines, basically the x, y, and z components of the spatial position for E. Let's say that when this event happens, let's say that at t equals 0 and at t prime equals 0, the two origins overlap, okay? And then at some time t later, you can see the current situation where S prime has moved a distance vt along the x-axis. So the origin O prime is now found at a distance vt along the x-axis in the S system. So in Galilean transformations, basically what you think of in Newtonian physics, the distance, which I've denoted as d, that is, if we look at the distance between O prime and the x-coordinate, where the event happens, which is x prime in the S prime system, that distance is equal to the x-coordinate of the event x in the S system, which you see down at the bottom of the drawing, minus the distance that S prime has moved since t equals 0. So that is, if you look at this drawing, x prime is equal to x minus vt. The transverse dimensions for the event don't change. They're the same in S and S prime, and S prime can move along the x-axis all you want, and those never change. Also, the time is Newtonian, so it moves, it's the same in both the S and the S prime systems. So that's what we're used to. If we go to slide 5, let's look at the relativistic system. Remember, what happens is at t equals 0, the O and O prime events, the O and the O prime overlap. S prime is moving along the x-axis. At some time t later, an event happens, and what I'd like to do is to relate the coordinates of that event in the S frame and find what are those coordinates in the S prime frame. So I want to transform the coordinates from S to S prime. So now, in this case, this is relativistic, so we have to take into account the length contraction and time dilation, basically. So let's think about that. If you're sitting in S and S prime is flying by, X prime represents the X coordinate of the event happening in the S prime system, and that's a length. If I now perceive that from the S system, I will perceive it to be shortened by a factor gamma because of length contraction. So what I consider to be that x prime length is going to be something shorter than what is seen in the s prime system. I will call that factor d. So d represents x prime in the s prime system as seen in the s system. So d is equal to x prime divided by gamma, which you see where I have the blue A in a circle. I can pull the gamma over. X prime is equal to d times gamma. In the S system, x is what I think of as the full, as the event position along the x system. So the d then has to be equal to the total x that I measure minus vt. But d I know to be x prime over gamma. Therefore, x prime, which is the coordinate as seen in the s prime system, is equal to gamma times x minus vt, which is the equation where I have a blue b in a circle. And this expression relates the observations I make in the S system, the X and the T, and converts them into what I see in the prime system. So that's how I get the X prime from the unprime stuff. Transversely, there everything is the same, so Y prime is equal to Y and Z prime is equal to Z, and I'm going to talk about T in a moment, but it's complicated, so we'll get to that in a minute. Well, I wish I could slow down and ask you guys for questions here. This is, unfortunately, some of this would be better if I had a laser pointer and could point at things for you. But I'm not set up to do that right at the moment, so sorry. Let's go to slide 6. Let's look at this exact same problem, but now what I'd like to do is to look at it from the point of view of the prime, and let's look to see how to convert things from the prime system into the unprime system. So from the prime system point of view, it's sitting still, and the S system is moving, but of course it's now moving in the negative X direction in order for the same setup to basically be true, the same physical aspects to be true. In the prime system, the distance between the origins is going to be VT prime. The distance to where the event happens in X is going to be X prime, and I'll say that the total distance from where the event happens to where, d prime would represent the distance that the person in the prime system would perceive as the distance as measured in by the people in the S system. Boy, did that make sense? If you look at the drawing, D prime represents what a person in the S prime system would see as the S coordinate without taking relativistic things into account yet. Okay, so X is the proper length in S. D prime is X as seen in S prime. So if we think of X being the proper length in the S frame, D prime has to be equal to X divided by gamma because we have length contraction. So stop the recording and ponder that one if you need to. So X is the distance from the origin O to the position that I've marked A on the X prime axis in S. That distance, as seen in S prime, will be shorter by a factor of gamma. I will call that distance D prime. So D prime is equal to X over gamma. by the relationship of what I'm thinking of VT prime, X prime, and D prime are, shown in pink on the drawing, I can see that X prime is equal to D prime minus VT prime. And that's all from the prime point of view. But D prime I know is X over gamma, so I substitute in for that. And then I solve for X in terms of the prime components. So I find that X is seen is going to be equal to gamma times X prime plus VT prime. And that's where I have a blue B in a circle. If we look at where on page 6 where I have a blue B in a circle, I have X is equal to gamma X prime plus VT prime. And if we look where I have a blue B in a circle on page 5, you see that I have X prime is equal to gamma X minus VT prime, VT. So you can see that if you transform from S to S prime, or from S prime to S, they really only vary by the sign of the velocity. So these transformations hold true for the spatial coordinates in such a situation. So let's go to page 7. If you go to page 7, let me take those two equations we just discussed, the transformation from prime to unprime and from unprime to prime, and put them at the top where I have an A in a circle. And so you can see those two equations we've just derived. What I'd like to do is to take the left-hand equation and substitute in the right-hand equation for X prime. So when I do that, you get the blue B in a circle. X is equal to gamma times the quantity gamma X minus VT plus VT prime. So I'm going to pull the gammas in and just expand those terms on the right-hand side, and you get the equation, the next equation, where I have an E in a circle. And now I'll regroup terms, solving for X on the left-hand side. I get 1 minus gamma squared quantity times X. And on the right-hand side, I get gamma V times the quantity T prime minus gamma T. Now, I want to take advantage of what these various quantities are. If you look where I have a blue C in a circle, we defined the quantity beta to be V over C. That's commonly done in relativity, so that's basically a variable you should just get used to. And with that definition of beta, 1 minus gamma squared, you can prove to yourself, is equal to minus gamma squared times beta squared. So if we go to where I have a blue F in a circle, the 1 minus gamma squared on the left-hand side, I can rewrite as minus gamma squared beta squared. And when I do that, I can then algebraically solve for T prime. So at T prime is equal to gamma times T minus V over C squared X at the bottom of the page. And I then pull that result out and put it where I have the pink D in a circle. And that is the transformation of the time from the unprimed frame to the primed frame. Let's go to page 8. Similarly, if I want to go from the primed frame to the unprimed frame at the top of page 8, you derive the result that I show there. It's the same as what we had on page 7, except for the sign of the velocity again. I'm not going to ask you to do that as an exercise because it's just a pain in the butt. But it's just algebra. Okay, so let me pull all these things together. And on page 8, so what we have are what we call the Lorentz transformations. That is, if you want to go from the S to S prime system, and this would be for relative motion along the X, if we look at our little sketch where I have an A in a circle, I have an S system, an S prime system moving with respect to the to the unprimed system with a velocity v, and some event happens, and that event will have coordinates x, y, z, t in S, and x prime, y prime, z prime, and t prime in S prime. If I know the coordinates in one of these systems, I can find the coordinates in the other system using Lorentz transformations. So to go from S to S prime, I get the four equations you see on the left, and to go from S prime to S, where I have a blue C in the circle, you would get the four equations you have on the right. You can see the symmetry in the equations basically only vary by the sign of this velocity V. And I think that may be one of the more, when you start actually doing problems, one of the things that may be most confusing is to when to use which of these sets of equations. And I'm not really sure I have an easy rule of thumb for you. When we go from S to S prime, we're dealing with a situation where the velocity along the direction X is going, where the other reference frame is moving in the positive X direction. And then from the other point of view, going from S prime to S, the S is moving in the negative X direction. So I think you sort of have to think about it that way, which set of the equations you pull out. Let's go to slide 9. Let's go back to slide 8. If you look at this, you note that the transformation of the spatial position depends on both the spatial and time, the spatial position and the time in the other reference frame. Similarly, the time, say, in the prime frame depends on both the position and the time in the unprime frame. So the idea of simultaneity is really all screwed up if we think about it, because we have this absolute idea of simultaneous because we have this idea of the absolute value of time, that all points in space are marching through an absolute immutable time at the same rate. So we can define simultaneous as everything that happens at a particular time. The problem that we have now is that if we're transforming from one reference frame to another, the time of each of the events that happen in one reference frame, when you go to the other reference frame, depend not only on the time that it happened in the first reference frame, but also the position. And those positions will all vary. So we get something really screwy. Let me just sort of illustrate it. If you go to slide 9, imagine that we're in a rocket ship that has a geosynchronous orbit. That is, it's basically stationary above one point on Earth. And let's say that we're in that rocket ship and we're looking down at the United States on the 4th of July, the evening of 4th of July. And let's say that everybody in the United States decided that they would blow their fireworks simultaneously at, let's say, 9 o'clock California time, so that it's dark everywhere, all right? So if it's 9 p.m. California time, it's midnight East Coast time, but everybody in all the time zones decides exactly what time they're going to do it, midnight on the East Coast, 9 o'clock on the West Coast, so that from the point of view of space, basically at the stroke of midnight East Coast time, you see fireworks lighting up all across the United States, okay? And you would say that all of those events happen simultaneously. But imagine if you're now looking at the same physical thing happening, but you are zipping by in a spaceship at some very high rate of speed, some large fraction of the speed of light. Now what's going to happen is that the time in the, let's call the geosynchronous orbit point of view, let's call that S, okay, and let's call the moving system S prime. If things happen all at the same time in the S system, but they all happen with different positions, then it means that necessarily you're going to see them happen at different times in the Prime system. So the people coming by in the fast rocket ship are not going to see all these fireworks going off at the same time. They're going to see them going off at different times, because in the transformation coming from the S system, where they are simultaneous, the space piece gets all mixed in and it's different. So the whole idea of simultaneity is a good bit more complicated and not at all so simple in relativity. So let's go to slide 10. So let's look at an example of this, just to show you how strange this can be. Let us suppose that we have two separate events that happen. The first event is that a rocket ship passes an asteroid. And let's say that the rocket ship, when it passes the asteroid, we're going to have two coordinate systems. One is the coordinate system of the asteroid, and the other is the coordinate system of the rocket ship, which I'm calling S prime. For the coordinate system of the asteroid, is S. Okay. Let's say that the rocket ship zips by the asteroid at 70% the speed of light. If we calculate what the gamma factor is, that we can calculate out to be 1.4. So let's say that there are two different events that happen. The first event is the rocket ship passes the asteroid, and although it wouldn't be cool for the rocket ship to actually hit the asteroid, let's sort of assume that the coordinate systems actually overlap exactly right at t equals 0. So at t equals 0, t prime is equal to 0, and the origins coincide. The second event that happens is people on the asteroid and people on the rocket will see a laser flash. And let us say that on S, that is, the people on the asteroid will perceive this laser to flash at a position x equal 3 kilometers, so it's 3 kilometers out along the x direction from the asteroid, and they will perceive this light laser to flash at 5 microseconds. If t in the S system is 0 at the time the rocket ship passes, then 5 microseconds after the rocket ship passes the asteroids, the people on the asteroid will see the laser flash from a distance of 3 kilometers. Okay? So then the question is, I know what event 1 is. It's defined basically to be happening at x equals 0 and at t and t prime equals 0. So I know what it looks like even to the people in the rocket ship. What does event 2 look like to people in the rocket ship? And for this, I need to do the relativistic transformation. The position, which I'll call x2 prime, that would be the position for event 2 happening in the prime system, is we get that from doing the Lorentz transformation for the spatial component along the direction of relative motion. So that would be x2 prime is equal to gamma times x2, that is the position of event 2 happening in the unprime system, minus v times t2, where t2 is the time of it happening in the unprime system. So I then basically substitute in numbers. So gamma is 1.4. The position x2 in the unprime system is 3 kilometers. I go 70% the speed of light, so v becomes 0.7 times 3 times 10 to the 5 kilometers per second. I got to stay in the right units. And the time that is perceived for event 2 to happen in the unprime system is 5 microseconds, so that t2 becomes 5 times 10 minus 6. So when I calculate that out, I find that the position x2 prime, that is the position where the people on the rocket ship perceive the laser flash to happen, is at 2.73 kilometers. So that's different from 3 kilometers. That may make sense because remember that 3 kilometers, you can think of that distance as being in the proper frame of the asteroid. So if I'm going to be moving with respect to that and measure it, I should measure something shorter, and we do, 2.73 kilometers. The time, if we do a similar calculation and we calculate the time for the rocket people to perceive the laser to flash, it's equal to gamma times the quantity T2 minus V over C squared times X2. I substitute in these various numbers, and when I do, I get minus 2.8 microseconds. So I hope that seems a little bit weird to you. The people on the asteroid perceive the rocket ship to pass, and then they see the laser flash. The people on the asteroid see the rocket ship pass, and then they see the laser flash 5 microseconds later. The people on the rocket ship see the laser flash 2.8 microseconds before they pass the asteroid. So we've even changed the ordering of the events by going from one reference frame to another in this case. So you think, whoa, this is really strange. In this example, the two events are far enough apart that there is not sufficient time for light to travel from one to the other in either of the reference frames. So they actually cannot possibly be causally connected. And in those circumstances, you can actually flip the orders of the events. If the events occurred close enough in space that light could have traveled from one place to the other, then what you'll find is that you can't mathematically flip the ordering, and causality is preserved. So we can look at that graphically a bit using space-time diagrams. So let's go to slide 11. So in a space-time diagram, what I do for a typical space-time diagram, you draw the dimension of relative motion, which would be x in this case, and then the y-coordinate will be c times time. Now, if you think about it, in a given system, c is the speed of light times the time that has elapsed gives you the distance that light goes in a certain amount of time. So on this an axis like this, light, if it's traveling, say, in the x direction, will move exactly a distance c times t in the x direction. If it's traveling in the negative x direction, it will move minus c times t. So that means that in such a coordinate system, light will travel along 45-degree lines. If something is at rest, like where I have a blue A in a circle, its x-coordinate doesn't change, but time passes. So it moves as a function of time straight up in this diagram. We call that the world line of that observer. So if you're at rest in the system, you're not moving at all, your position doesn't change as a function of time, so you simply stay at the same x and you chart out a world line that's parallel to the CT axis. A photon, on the other hand, going in the x or minus x direction, will chart out a world line like what you see where I have a blue C in a circle. That is, the photon will move a distance CT in a time when will move a distance CT in a time T. And so you'll end up charting 45-degree lines on this kind of plot. If we could imagine having a rocket leaving Earth at T equals zero, it's going to be, and let's say X is straight up, it's going to accelerate, so it will start to cover more and more X as a function of time. So its slope sort of increases as it's accelerating, and then it slows down, and then at the top of its motion, it's at rest, so the tangent to this pink line that I've drawn is at one moment parallel to the CT axis, and then the rocket starts to fall, and it starts to fall fairly fast, so the slope of this line becomes it sort of bends in more and more toward the CT axis. Note, though, that, and maybe I didn't draw this quite right, but the slope really should not come anywhere close to 45 degrees because it's not going at the speed of light when it hits the Earth. So if we go to slide 11, we have you can sort of think of you at the present being where you're sitting in X for CT, where T is equal to zero. We define zero to be your present. And now we can look at things that are in your future, and you can see the yellow cone moving in positive CT. As time passes, light can travel to you from farther and farther distances. So, for example, 1 second after this moment, light from a distance C times 1 second could have traveled to you. So, in that 1 second, anything within that distance could be causally connected to you. So we call that part of you're causally connected to that part of the world. That's your positive light. That's the region of space which is defined by your light cone. Things that are so far away from you that that light has not had time to reach you from that point, you are causally disconnected from it. And when you do calculations like we did a moment ago with the rocket ship passing the asteroid, the events can actually change ordering. So, I mean, you're not causally connected to things that are outside of your light cone. Those things that are inside your light cone, where you can be causally connected, we call that region a time-like region, and the distance is less than C tau, CT. If you go outside the light cone, then we have what we call the space-like region, where the distance is greater than CT, and that is forever outside of your experience. Similarly, we can project from your present back to the past and sort of plot your world line, which tells your position as a function of time. And you can sort of see, as you go further back in time, more of the universe is causally connected to you. And as you go ahead in time, the further out you go, the more of the universe is potentially connected to you. At some time T prime, if you look at it, you can sort of see your future at time T prime, which I've drawn in red. Okay. Let's go to slide 13. Well, let's go back to slide 12 for a moment. I understand we may want to chat a bit about what we're doing on slide 12. It may not make sense to some of you having to do this in this mode of just talking at myself in a room. But we can come back to this and try to go through some examples, perhaps, so you're comfortable with it. Let's go to slide 13. We've talked about transformations of space. We've talked about transformations of time. We've talked about how those two things get all mixed together when you transform from one reference frame to another. You can observe things besides space and time, so we have to have transformation rules for other things as well. For example, suppose we're in some reference system and we measure a velocity. A ball is moving at some angle in our reference system and we measure it to have a velocity. What would that look like in a different reference system moving with respect to the first? So that's what I illustrate in the upper left-hand corner of slide 13, where we have an object moving with velocity u, which is shown where I have a blue A in a circle. So u is a vector, so it's a three velocity. It's a three vector, a three component vector, ux, uy, uz, for example. And we're going to say that u is the velocity as measured in the S system. So u in the x is equal to dx dt, u in the y is dy dt, and u in the z is equal to dz dt. And now what I'd like to do is ask, what does that velocity look like if it's measured from the point of view of somebody who is moving in the S prime reference frame with a velocity v along the x prime direction? So what we really want to get is, what is u sub x prime? What is the x component of the velocity as measured by someone in the prime system? Well, by definition of what they mean by the velocity in their system, ux prime is going to be equal to dx prime over dt prime. We don't know what that quantity is with respect to variables in the S system, but we do know how x transforms and we know how t transforms. So x prime is going to be gamma x minus vt. So if I now take the derivative, the differential of that, I basically say dx prime becomes gamma dx minus v dt. Similarly, dt prime becomes gamma dt minus v over c squared dx. So all I've done, where I have the blue E in a circle, is I have transformed the denominator and the numerator separately using the Lorentz transformations for x and t that we already have, and I've preserved the differential. So if I have a little dx prime, it means I'm transforming with a dx and a dt. Okay? So then what I'd like to do is to divide both the top and the bottom by dt. So as I go from where I have a blue E in a circle to the next step, to the right of that, I'll get gamma times dx over dt, but that's what we've defined as u sub x, minus v, because it's v dt and I divide by dt, so it's just v. The denominator becomes gamma times 1 minus v over c squared times dx over dt, which again is u sub x. So if you look where I have a blue D in a circle, you get the transformation that we're looking for at least the x coordinate. So along the direction of relative motion, the velocity coordinate transforms as shown by the equation in the blue circle on the right-hand side of slide 13. Ux prime is equal to ux minus v over 1 minus v over c squared ux. So it depends on the velocity as measured in the S system, and it depends on the relative velocity. And this is known as the velocity transformation for the direction of relative motion. If we go to slide 14, the problem is that, remember, the transverse dimensions have a simpler transformation. They're the same. So if we look at UI, and we ask, how does it transform? UI prime, again, is equal to dy prime over dt prime. But now the numerator, dy prime, is just equal to dy. So it's different from what we had when we were looking at the component along the direction of relative motion. The bottom transforms exactly like what we saw earlier. Again, where I have the blue A in a circle and you go all the way to the right, if I divide the numerator denominator by T, you see that I get UI on the top and gamma 1 minus V over C squared UX on the bottom. Okay, remember that DT prime transforms, but it doesn't transform with the Y component in there. If the direction of relative motion is along the X, it gets the X component. So where I have the blue B in a circle, you get the transformation for the one of the transverse components of the velocity. UI prime is equal to UI divided by gamma times the quantity 1 minus UX V over C squared. And the other transverse dimension, Z, is going to be quite similar. So instead of UI prime and UY, you have UZ prime and UZ, but the denominator stays the same in both cases. So if we go to slide, so if we look at slide 13 and 14, you see three separate circled, blue circled equations, and those represent the velocity component transformations for ordinary velocity. Okay, so let's do a little example. Let's consider we have two subatomic particles that are moving toward one another. One is moving to the left at 80% the speed of light, and the other is moving to the right at 90% the speed of light, and they're about to bash into one another. And my question for you is, what is the relative velocity of one of these particles with respect to the other? I want you to think about that for a moment. I'm going to shut up for a second to give you a chance to think about that. Okay, so you can pause things if you want, but let's go to slide 16. I think naively what you want to say, if you have a point 8 approaching a point 9 going in opposite directions, you're going to think they've got to be approaching each other at 1.7 times the speed of light. But that's really not the right answer. Okay, so I think that is what many people would think looking at this. So let's look at this problem, the way the solution goes. The problem as we set it up, you can imagine that you're in a system S, and when you are in that system, you have a particle, which I'll call particle A, moving with U sub A, going at 0.9C from left to right along the X direction, if you want. Similarly, we have a particle U sub B going from right to left at 0.8C. Okay, so that is from one particular frame of reference. What I'd like to do to really answer the question, which is how fast are they moving relative to one another, that is, how fast does one of them perceive the other to be approaching them, I want to transform to a different coordinate system. I want to transform to a coordinate system which is at rest with respect to one of those particles. I'm going to choose particularly to transform to the S prime system, which is moving at a velocity V equal to 0.9C, so that the S prime system is at rest with respect to particle A. And then I'm going to ask, what is the velocity U prime of particle B in that new reference frame, which is at rest with respect to particle A? That really is the essence of the problem that we're asking. So we can get that by taking the velocity in the S system and transforming it into what we would see in the S prime system. And we do that where I have a Roman numeral 3 in a blue circle at the bottom. We are transforming along the direction of relative motion, so we would use the form of the equation which we have on slide 13. So the velocity u prime is equal to the velocity as measured in the S system, which is ub, minus v, which is the relative velocity of the two reference frames, over 1 minus v over c squared times ub. And then I plug in all those various numbers, noting that u sub b is going negative in the S system, so it comes in with a negative sign here. And what we'll find after you plug everything in is that you get the relative velocity to be, or the velocity u prime is found to be 0.988c going in the negative direction. So as strange as it may seem, if I'm in a reference system where I have these two particles where they're going toward each other and one is going at 9/10 the speed of light and one's going at 8/10 the speed of light, and if I ask how fast they see each other approaching each other, the answer is only 98.8% of the speed of light. So relativity is pretty strange, especially as you, because of these gamma factors and things, you get very strange behavior as velocities approach the speed of light, and you get sort of limiting things, such as you cannot come up with a situation where the relative velocity that you would see here would exceed the speed of light. All right, so let's go to slide 17. As you've seen, we've found transformations for space and time, and then a quantity like an ordinary velocity transformed in a way that seemed somewhat complicated, and the reason it was somewhat complicated was because it contained in the numerator a spatial piece that had to transform, and in the denominator a time piece that had to transform. And so with all the various transformations going on in that thing, it became sort of complicated. Let's think about that velocity for a moment, and let me ask a question, and let's see if that is a relevant quantity or whether we need to be thinking about something else. Let us suppose, in celebration of the flu season that we're all sharing now, let us suppose that you have a stomach bug, and this stomach bug is such that you get sick exactly every 20 minutes, okay? And you need to go to a hospital, and the hospital is on the next planet from where you are, which is 5 times 10 to the 7th kilometers away. So my question for you, suppose you're on a rocket ship that is passing the point where you are right now, and you need to be at a hospital 5 times 10 to the 7th kilometers away. How fast does that rocket ship have to move in order for you not to get sick on that rocket ship? So what that really means is that the rocket ship has to move a distance of 5 times 10 to the 7th kilometers in true distance of the reference frame that we're sitting in, but it has to move that distance in your stomach time, not necessarily in the time of the reference frame of the unmoving system. So what's really relevant is a velocity that uses your proper time instead of some other passage of time, like the ordinary time component. Remember, proper time is a very specific thing. It is the passage of time in the reference frame of the object in question. Okay? So we want to define a velocity which is equal to dx over d tau, where tau is defined as the time in the proper frame of reference. And we're going to call this velocity, and it's a different velocity from ordinary velocity, because remember, ordinary velocity is dx over dt, and it changes from reference frame to reference frame to reference frame. Both the dx and the dt change depending on which reference frame you're in. For proper velocity, the dx transforms from reference frame to reference frame, but tau, for whatever it is you're talking about, that is fixed, right? There's only one reference frame which measures the proper time for whatever event you're talking about. And in this example, it would be that reference frame where your stomach is, which would happen to be on the rocket ship when you're going from one place to another. So I hope I've convinced you that there's a reason that we need to define a special sort of velocity, and it's one that has only a spatial part that transforms, and the time part doesn't transform. It's fixed depending on what it is you're talking about. So let's go to page 18. I'm going to give a symbol, which is this sort of scripty M. It's called eta. Eta sub x is going to be equal to dx over d tau. And remember, tau doesn't transform. That's just in one reference frame, always defined to be that reference frame. But x does transform. And in fact, we already know, we can relate eta and velocity. Because we know how regular time in some reference frame is related to the proper time. And that's through time dilation. So if you look where we have a blue B in a circle, the time as measured in any reference frame is going to be equal to gamma times d tau. So if I measure in the proper frame some length of time d tau, I know that I'll measure in any other reference frame something longer due to time dilation by the factor gamma. So where I have a blue C in a circle, eta sub x, that's the proper time component in the x direction, is dx over d tau. Tau is equal to d tau is equal to dt over gamma. So dx over d tau becomes gamma dx over dt, which is gamma vx. So what we have is the proper velocity is equal to gamma times the regular velocity component in any other reference frame other than the proper frame. So we've defined the proper velocity, and now we want to think about what we can do with that. I want you to recall that we've looked at space and time transformation. Now, what that means is that we've actually looked at three spatial dimensions and time, and we've looked to see how they all get mixed together. So in a Lorentz transformation, you've seen that the space and the time manage to get mixed up. In other words, in relativity, things like spatial three vectors are not the quantity you really use. You end up needing to use things that have four components because four things get mixed up. In Lorentz transformations, the space components and the time get mixed up, and we call it space-time. So, in fact, in the mathematics that we generally will use for relativity, we don't talk about three vectors very much. In fact, we talk about four vectors, and x, y, z, and t constitute a four vector in relativity. It's the same thing as what you're used to with three vectors, except now it has four components. And now that we have, for example, what we call the proper velocity, we can define something called relativistic momentum, which can just be, just like regular momentum is mv. Here we'll define m eta to be the relativistic momentum. And just like we've looked at time and space things and how they transform as we go from one coordinate system to another, any observable that we look at, we have to know how it transforms. So if we have relativistic momentum, then a question might be, okay, let's see how it transforms. And it will involve a fourth component because Lorentz transformations involve four components, not three. So then the question is, what is that fourth component? So we're going to start here next time. And Gene Coley doesn't really talk about four vectors. I'm still trying to decide how far I'm going to drag you guys into that muck. It actually simplifies things. So I think I may actually go ahead and introduce you guys to four vectors, because it actually leads to a great simplification of much of the discussion that that Gene Coley gives, and gives us some power to do some other calculations. But I believe I will call it quits for today. I hope you guys are having a good week, and feel free to email me with questions. There's, I'm sure you feel the pain. Lots of primes and unprimes and S's and S primes and things that I refer to in this lecture. So I think the discussion may be helped somewhat by being able to do it in person. So at any rate, keep track of your questions. Those which you think I might be able to answer well via email, go ahead and send them to me if you wish, and I'll try to answer them. Otherwise, I'll certainly give you time for questions when I'm back in town next Monday. So I hope you've had a good week. I'm going to assign you a problem set which will be due let me look at the time. Which will be due on the 25th. So it will not be all of our relativity problems, but it will be get us started on relativity. So, anyway, hope you having a good week. Bye.